Hi, I'm Jess Graham, and I'm the community builder at the Transnational Institute. Our world is in a state of flux and crisis. The pandemic exposed the deep injustice of our economic and social system, but failed to trigger more needed change. More than 2 years on, the health crisis continues, compounded by spiraling food and energy prices, escalating wars and geopolitical tensions, and ever more signs of environmental collapse. Worldwide, anger at political leaders' failures to address these crises is seething and could explode in the coming months. How are we meant to make sense of this moment? What does it mean for activists and social movements? What are the challenges we must confront and the opportunities we must seize? To help tackle these and other questions, we'd like to invite you to our first ever State of the World Conference, an exciting opportunity to hear some of the best scholar activists worldwide with a truly internationalist analysis of the state of the world. We've brought together exciting speakers from across the globe, including Walden Bellow, Kate Raworth, and others with brilliant analysis and areas of expertise and experience. This conference will run over 4 days, the 14th to the 17th of September, 2022, with 2 sessions a day. We've scheduled it to maximize participation from different areas of the globe, and it will be held with simultaneous interpretation in English and Spanish. Please be sure to sign up and join us as we collectively make sense of the moment we are in. You can check the podcast description for the link or just go to tni.org. Hope to see you there. Thanks.
Lack of access to modern energy services remains a major constraint to economic development in many regions, and perhaps in Africa most of all. According to the Africa Development Bank, only 40% of the continent's people have regular access to electricity. African governments are trying to expand their capacity to provide energy to their citizens, and this has seen a proliferation of mega energy deals, where governments sign deals with investors, usually foreign, who pledge to work with the government to build energy generation facilities, upgrade energy grids, and other such cost-intensive developments. However, this all happens in a context where we know what we have to do to solve the climate crisis. We must keep oil, coal, and gas in the ground. What happens when African governments try to pass progressive policies to protect the environment and to protect people from some of the harmful practices of these investors? The fossil fuel industry has a secret powerful weapon to keep countries locked in on fossil fuels: the Energy Charter Treaty. The ECT is an international investment agreement that establishes a multilateral framework for cross-border cooperation in the energy industry. The treaty covers all aspects of commercial energy activities and is currently on a massive geographical expansion into Africa, Asia, and Latin America. History shows that though the Energy Charter Treaty makes many promises of burgeoning investment, the reality is that it does not significantly improve investment prospects. Instead, the ECT's Investor State Dispute Settlement Provisions, ISDS, give foreign investors in the energy sector sweeping rights to directly sue states in international tribunals of 3 private lawyers called arbitrators. Companies can be awarded dizzying sums in compensation for government actions that have allegedly damaged their investments, either directly through expropriation or indirectly through regulations or policies of virtually any kind. Here at the State of Power podcast, we're concerned with power, how it can be generated in a fair and equitable manner without endangering the planet or livelihood. On this episode of the podcast, we take a specific look at East Africa, where 5 of the East African Community, EAC, countries have signed the non-legally binding International Energy Charter, which is a political declaration aimed at strengthening energy cooperation among signatory countries and international organizations, and does not impose any legal or financial obligation. The governments of Burundi, Tanzania, and Uganda signed the IEC in 2015, the government of Rwanda in 2016, and the government of Kenya and the East African Community as an intergovernmental institution itself signed the charter in 2017. As a consequence of this political declaration, the ECT Secretariat, whose survival depends on the continuation of the Energy Charter Treaty, continues to lobby these countries to take additional steps towards acceding to the treaty, which, because of its ISDS clauses, is not as innocuous as the International Energy Charter. In many of those countries in the process of acceding to the ECT, hardly anyone seems to have ever heard of the Energy Charter Treaty, let alone have thoroughly examined its political, legal, and financial risks. And even with the supposed modernization process, which is supposed to deal with the problematic clauses in the agreement, the treaty continues to threaten to bind yet more countries to corporate-friendly energy policies. To get a better understanding of what exactly is going on, we speak to Olivia Costa, who is the Executive Director of Tanzania Trade and Investment Coalition, a grouping of 13 civil society organizations in the East African country. Joining her is Brenda Ankankunda, who works with the Southern and Eastern Africa Trade Information and Negotiations Institute, SEATINI, and is based in Uganda. Both organizations have a focus on trade and investment. I began by asking Brenda, of what relevance is the ECT, the Energy Charter Treaty, to the African context?
Thank you. When you look at the framing of the Energy Charter Treaty and the conversation that has been around it, you ideally realize that there is a call towards investing within the energy sector. And that leads us to reflecting on the status of our energy sector as the African continent. First of all, our access to energy, especially electricity, is as low as 40% for the continent. And that shows you how much African countries would be much willing to make an investment in any area so that they can be able to exploit their energy and be able to at least increase access to maybe electricity. But also looking at countries like Uganda, that at the moment they're even moving towards, you know, oil is one of the discussions they are having, and they think that by tapping into it, they could be able to gain a lot of revenue. So there's a lot of discussion around tapping within the resources in the energy sector. And the Energy Charter Treaty, in a sense that it is shaped, and a discussion I think that is well driven by the Secretariat, you realize that there's a call that this is a tool that can help the African continent to be able to exploit their resources within the energy sector. Well, not to say that it's the reality, but I think that is the face that the Energy Charter Treaty has been given out there. And that is why we see a lot of countries having interest every other day to see how they can rely on this tool to be able to tap into their energy resources.
So this is the African continent needs to develop its energy sector more than any other part of the world, essentially. And this is where you have the most room for growth for the energy sector.
Yes. Now, let me just give you an example. When you read the African Development Bank statistics, they show that over 640 million Africans have no access to energy. So that shows you that, first of all, there's that gap. And because of that gap, we see even the policymakers trying to ensure that they make an effort to bridge that gap and be able to exploit their energy resources.
So are there any countries in particular that are more in the firing line, so to speak? Olivia, what are those countries that are now at this particular moment trying to get in on the ECT? And what's the process around their accession to it?
Okay, thank you very much. As Brenda just said, African countries, well, they have similarities when it comes to energy stability. As she's pointed out, Uganda, they have as low as 40%. Countries in Africa, they have an urge to make sure that they have power stability all the year round. But they have some constraints like climate change, which see countries getting fewer rains throughout the year. So this leads to energy shortage And with the fact that most African countries, we don't have an energy mix set yet. So we end up having these power issues of rationing always throughout the year. So now the Secretariat lures our policymaker into signing ECT by giving them false promises. You know, we know what they are, and we're thinking, well, this is not something that can work in our countries. But for them, they're thinking, okay, by signing this, it can help into reducing the problem or ending the power or energy shortage problem in our countries. But in reality, signing our ECT will not end this power instability in African countries. But rather, we know that ECT is a monster that if one welcomes in their homes, it has a lot of bad issues. In Africa, the countries that we know, they are in a firing line. So far, we have Burundi, Eswatini, and Mauritania that they are in the final stage of acceding to the ECT. And after that, there will be a national ratification. Uganda is the only country currently awaiting invitation to accede to the ECT. And Brenda is the witness, and you also the witness that they have tried to work with the policymakers so that they can hold this process. Morocco, Niger, and Chad are undertaking internal approval of their own accession reports. As it has been heard, and we'll hear it later, Western countries now, a country like Nigeria, the Secretary General of the ECT has been in the country lately and met with the government officials. There are also countries like Benin, the Gambia, and Senegal that are in the process of preparing the accession reports with the support of the ECT Secretariat.
So there's essentially a potential for many African countries to end up being signatories to the ECT. And this is not just happening. It's not like these countries are just waking up and deciding, oh, hey, there's something called the ECT. We're going to go and join. The ECT Secretariat has been pushing the ECT on the continent, no? Maybe we can have a closer look at some of the arguments and mechanisms that they've used to get countries to begin this process of trying to join. Would you like to give us a little bit more understanding of how this is happening, Brenda?
Well, you realize that, for instance, in 2019, when Uganda sent out a letter expressing its interest to join the Energy Charter Treaty, and there was a lot of discussion that changed the focus. And at the moment, we were convinced that the Energy Charter Treaty is actually halted as it undergoes modernization, which has just recently, I think, the modernized agreement. Well, though not really reflective, but we've seen it put out there. But even when we heard of that, you know, halt, we still feel that it is a halt, but not in a nutshell, because we realized that it wasn't actually true, as we see that the ECT Secretariat actually went on to do work and specifically to influence most of the countries within the Global South to be party to this agreement. One of the questions I used to ask around last year, and I think earlier before now that we have the modernized agreement, was that why, if say it is halted, why do we keep seeing that there's a huge budget that is specifically meant for the expansion? It ideally shows you that there was nothing like a halt, but maybe that is something that we were meant to believe. But we see, and African countries are still going on, and not just Africa, but also entirely countries in the Global South are just going on to look at the expansion. So for me, the question that I had was, if there was actually a geographical expansion of the ECT, if that geographical expansion was stopped, and I think that it wasn't, but rather a shield to ensure that those that make noise, especially us as civil society, that, you know, try to put out a call to ensure that maybe our voices are suppressed, I could say. But what I can tell you is that this process has been ongoing, and that is why we see that countries, even up to date, are still into this process. And I think they've there's been that background work that has been going on to ensure that countries are actually convinced and can be able to go on and accede to the ECT.
So essentially, the ECT Secretariat was like, okay, there's a lot of noise that the treaty is not working or is not fair in particular ways. We're going to change some aspects of it to make it better. And this, they made it seem like this was a halt to the actual or whole process of getting countries to join. But in the background, they did not in any way stop their process of trying to get countries to join. Is that a proper understanding of what this, because I want to understand, what is this modernization process of the ECT?
It is exactly as you mentioned. And this, for me, I think the whole modernization process was just aimed at giving some false hopes to everyone that put out a cry and you know, trying to expose the problematic clauses that are within the Energy Charter Treaty. Talk about things to do with the investor-state dispute settlement, the zombie clauses, the fact that it doesn't provide for investor obligations. So I think because of that large outcry, it is why we saw the Secretariat, because I think, you know, they couldn't stand the pressure. We saw the Secretariat coming out to say, okay, we're going to focus on modernizing it now. But even when you look at the agreement that has just come out, you realize that clauses like the regulatory chill, which was one of the issues that we actually highly advocated for and said, we cannot have a regulatory chill in this particular treaty because...
Would you care to explain a little quickly, just for somebody who doesn't understand, what you mean by regulatory chill?
Okay. When you look at the Energy Charter Treaty, it has a clause that compels countries, even after they have decided to exit the Energy Charter Treaty, previously, that said you would still be held liable or you would still be sued under the Energy Charter Treaty for is it around 25 years, even after you have exit the Energy Charter Treaty?
Wow.
I think for me that as African countries, this is something that we actually need to open our eyes to. It shows you how much this treaty is focused on protecting the investment itself. And one other challenge that I actually realized with the Energy Charter Treaty is that even when you read it, the only thing it talks about is the obligations of the host states to mention. For instance, if maybe a company is in Uganda, it just focuses on how is Uganda protecting the investor or the investment. There is no component that looks at investor obligation to the host community. And that is why we've over time seen a lot of economic, social, and cultural injustices in our society, because the framing of our policies, of the treaties, of the investment agreements that we sign are not reflective of those particular rights. So when you look at the Energy Charter Treaty, bringing in a clause that even after you have exit, you can still be sued. I read
for 25 years. So this is essentially we're in a marriage and we divorce, but even if after we've divorced for 25 years, you still have your rights essentially as a spouse. Wow.
And I read the 2020 report of the ACTAD, and it showed that the highest investor state disputes are cases that were registered out of investment treaties, the largest were as a result of the Energy Charter Treaty.
So out of all the treaties that have this sort of these clauses, these investor state dispute settlement clauses that protect investors, the highest value that has been that countries have been sued for has been through the ECT.
Yes. What you refer to the most recent report by the ACTAD, that is what it reflects.
So countries are still signing up to the ECT. As you say, there are countries that are requesting to join, like Uganda. There are countries that are now in the final stages of joining the ECT. My question is, what is it that countries don't get? Is the ECT needed to attract foreign investment? Like, is there any proof that countries need to sign on in order to get investment? Is And is it, when we talk about also the broader context of the energy transition in Africa, as you mentioned, that Africa already has a huge deficit in terms of energy. And so it's a question of catching up with getting enough energy for everyone and at the same time undergoing a transition, an energy transition. What are the pros and cons that countries are looking at? What's the cost of them joining the ECT?
Okay, let me just chip in first.
Yeah.
There's this whole discussion around the myths versus the reality.
Mm-hmm.
Myths that this is what the Energy Charter Treaty is putting on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Vis-a-vis the reality of what it is actually, how it is endangering the countries mm-hmm. that are planned to accede to it. But why mm-hmm. we see African countries being persuaded is because of those myths that come with the Energy Charter Treaty and I think the gospel that the Secretariat spreads. And that mm-hmm. is why, like I told you earlier in the beginning, that there's mm-hmm. a lot of need to, you know, invest within the energy sector. So when all yeah. these myths of how it is going to, you know, grow and attract a lot of revenue from its sector, that is why you see countries will keep being persuaded to join this Energy Charter Treaty. Mm-hmm. If countries need this particular treaty to maybe grow their energy sector, I personally believe that countries do not actually need it. Because, mm-hmm. first of all, now when you refer to countries like Uganda and look at even the regional geographical setting of maybe the East African community, we already have over 60 bilateral investment treaties that we have signed with the different mm-hmm. countries. Those are just bilateral. We have multilateral investment agreements.
Mm-hmm.
We are members to the World Trade Organization. There are a lot of opportunities and treaties that we are party to that we could rely on to exploit. And I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. We have a bilateral investment treaty with the Netherlands as mm-hmm. Uganda. Right now we see Total Energies, which is leading in this EACOP, which I believe you must have heard about. It is the East African crude oil pipeline.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So the leading company is Total Energies.
Mm-hmm.
Total Energies is a French company.
Mm-hmm.
But it is actually registered in Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And those are some of the dynamics. So in other words, we are already under an arrangement because we have a bilateral investment treaty, we have a double taxation agreement between Uganda and Netherlands. So we are mm-hmm. already into that kind of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if it was just about exploiting our energy resources, we already have treaties that we...
This should suffice.
Yes, that, like I'm giving you an example of the bilateral investment treaty that we have.
Yeah.
So it ideally shows you that there's no need whatsoever for having a separate treaty that is just focusing on the energy. And that mm-hmm. shows you that even when you dig deep into why it is actually focusing on the energy ministries, like in Uganda, mm-hmm. our investment treaties and agreements are signed by the Ministry of Finance. But you look at this Energy Charter Treaty, it is specifically targeting the energy sector, and that shows you where the gap is. So I think that countries do not need it, and we already have a lot of arrangements and treaties that we've signed with the several countries, so we could rely on those as opposed to the ECT.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the dangers of countries joining the ECT?
When you look at the dangers and risks that are associated with the ECT, first of all, the issue that it looks into the shrinking policy space of governments to regulate in the public interest. And this ideally means that by the time a country joins the Energy Charter Treaty, it loses its right to regulate in public interest. I gave you an example of the Lamu project and how community came out and the government was able to regulate and say, for the sake of our environment, we are stopping this project. That is the space that you lose the moment you join the Energy Charter Treaty. But also, too, looking at the fact that it actually undermines environmental protection, because we're talking about extracting fossil fuels here as one of the things that we look at. So it's also problematic in that very manner. And the other thing is that the Energy Charter Treaty also locks African countries into the failures of energy privatization. Now, you definitely give away the energy sector to the private sector. And what that means is that access to social services like electricity is definitely going to be so high. And especially for developing countries like Uganda, it becomes difficult for communities to access electricity because you have privatized the entire economy. So, and lastly, is for me the spirit in which the Energy Charter Treaty is made. The fact that it focuses on just the energy ministries. Yet energy ministries, I do not know in the other countries, but these are investment treaties are ideally negotiated by trade and finance. So looking at energy ministries, first of all, there is a capacity gap because they do not negotiate investment treaties. So it means that they are trying to woodwink them into something that they do not have expertise on, so that they can easily persuade them. So I think that those are some of the things that we must put a sharp eye to and look through them and see that we actually do not need this Energy Charter Treaty in place.
Olivia, you agree, you share these sentiments.
Oh yeah, definitely, I share them. And just to add up on what Brenda just said on the ECT being used for treaty shopping, 24 out of 25 supposedly Dutch investors who filed ECT lawsuit by October 2021, they were mailbox companies.
Wow.
Yeah, and I just checked today, there are actually 150, those known cases, ECT cases, in the International Energy Charter website. And these are dominated by countries from other continents at the moment. And we're thinking it's just a matter of time when African countries have ratified, we'll see a lot of these cases in there, because most of the cases that Africa has been sued on, majority they're emanating from energy sector.
So it seems as if these agreements are really not about improving Africa's access to electricity, but it's about people joining the queue to sue African countries for not fulfilling some clause or the other in the agreements.
Oh, yeah. When these investors come to your countries, they try to make it look like you're going to gain a lot of things. Say, for example, the argument the ECT Secretariat has, they're advocating on energy stability to the countries. And I, for one, if I didn't know this, I'll be like, oh, if they're going to help us with having energy stability in our country, why not? And then they'll say, oh, we'll have technological transfer. And thinking, oh, yeah, there's a lot of people who don't have work and they'll need this technological know-how. Mm-hmm. And maybe after a while, we'll have a generation which is well-developed, you know. And then they will also say it will come with economic growth. But in reality, we've witnessed a lot of agreements, as Brenda said, which what they have done is just to sue us and in the name of protecting their investment and not to advance anything for the host countries.
Mm-hmm. So the myth is we're going to bring you a lot of money, a lot of investment. You're going to see a boom in your energy production. And very soon everyone is going to be plugged to the electrical grid and Africa will have its final industrial age arriving. But the reality is, yeah, you're joining the queue to essentially be exploited in a more aggressive way.
Surely.
This is so I was going to ask, I mean, it seems somewhat obvious to me now already, but just to really put it down, who are the big winners then in this whole process of the Energy Charter Treaty and its expansion into the Global South and in particular into Africa?
It's not rocket science. is the investors.
Yeah. So who are these investors though? So it's the energy companies, or there's also like, I mean, I can imagine there's a lot of financial shenanigans going on as well, like where people are not even into energy, but are now kind of joining the queue to sue.
So let's take an example of Tanzania. There was, sometimes in the 90s, late 90s, there was a severe shortage of electricity. Mm-hmm. And so Tanzanian government, through the Tanzania Electrical Supply Company called TANESCO, they entered a power purchase agreement with Independent Power Tanzania Company, mm-hmm. which in reality is not from Tanzania. It's used by other people and then, you know, business things. Mm-hmm. And then they agreed to design, construct, own, operate, and maintain electricity generating facility, to operate this facility to deliver electricity generated by others, like local producers, to TANESCO for an initial of 20 years. And then there was the issue of tariffs to be paid under agreement that was supposed to be adjusted to account for capital cost, debt incurred, and maintenance cost, and fuel cost of the facility. Mm-hmm. Now, this IPTL had a joint venture with an engineering company, which was not a Tanzanian.
Mm-hmm. It was not a Tanzanian company.
Yeah, no. So they signed another PPA with the government. Uh-huh. As a government was used as a guarantor of the TANESCO. So mm-hmm. in case the TANESCO fails to pay the debt to IPTL, and then government will step in. Long story short, Tanzania has been sued 4 times.
So this is a public-private agreement that was guaranteed by the Tanzanian government. Mm-hmm. And then now they've been sued already 4 times, and this has been taken to...
So this case has been turned like several times. These investors, they really wanted to make sure that they get this money. So there was mm-hmm. a debt in between. There was a Hong Kong Standard Chartered Bank, which they say they borrowed money. IPTL said they borrowed money from Hong Kong Standard Chartered Bank. Mm-hmm. So Tanzania has been sued with them as well. And they have been back and forth with this case, I think up to this year. And the amount that Tanzania has been sued for this case up to the settlement, it's over 300 million.
Wow.
Yes.
And for an African country, that's essentially, that's a huge chunk of the country's production capacity already.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. This money could have gone to other places. It could be used in a health sector.
Healthcare, education, public services.
Public services, you know, it's a lot of money that we get sued and paid for no reason. And now they want us to sign ECT, whereas we have all these other cases coming from other agreements. Why should we do that?
Yeah. And I think what's also sometimes falls under the radar is how much money the legal cases themselves cost. Even if the country doesn't then have to pay, just paying all those lawyers and everyone to do the paperwork, all that money could have gone to buying medical equipment for hospitals that desperately need it.
Sure.
It's always frustrating when I hear how this thing works and how we Africans keep getting trapped into this sort of agreements. And the frustration sometimes leaves you thinking, okay, you know, it's terrible. What can I do? So, I mean, from your perspective, you're doing your work, Olivia, you're there in Tanzania, Brenda in Uganda. What is to be done, both in your countries and also in other countries where the ECT is a direct threat? What's our path of resistance?
We continue with awareness raising for citizens and tell them, ECT mm-hmm. is not going to address any shortage in Africa.
Yeah.
And also continue engaging with our policymakers, conducting information mm-hmm. sharing session with these policymakers, and have policy engagement at the national and regional level so that we are all in one page about these agreements.
Mm-hmm.
especially the ECT.
And for yourself, Brenda, what would be your message of resistance to anyone who's listening to this podcast?
Yeah, thank you. When you asked a question of who are the big winners, mm-hmm. something lingered in my mind on who are actually the losers. Mm-hmm. I think that as African continent, we are the losers when it comes to this. And looking at the fact that for the little effort we've made within our energy sector, mm-hmm. the Energy Charter Treaty comes in to undermine all those efforts. And I just want to quickly give you an example. In Uganda, and I think globally, there's a move towards privatization. In Uganda, we privatized even our electricity. We have a private company. And you realize that every other day, the tariffs keep going high. And mm-hmm. government has no say because this is something that has been privatized that is focusing on profit making. Mm-hmm. So that is a similar situation in which the ECT coming into place, it cannot even solve like a problem to do with the access to electricity. Because any company that comes out there is looking at how best it can maximize profit. Getting to what I think can be done, I think it's important that we get to appreciate what the implications are that come along with the Energy Charter Treaty. For me, that is all that we need. Because even if we do the sensitization, if we do not appreciate which implications this Energy Charter Treaty has, we're going to still live under the myth of how much it is bringing to our sectors when it comes to the energy. So I think that we need to appreciate, and maybe it's our role as civil society, to continue with the sensitization, specifically on how it is going to impact us. We are having a lot of challenges here in Uganda, even challenges going to an extreme of food shortage. But when you look deep into them, most of them are as a result of the climate change. So we already look at, first of all, we're talking about fossil fuels. How much is it endangering our environment? Do we have the sovereignty to even speak when we say, like our neighbors in Kenya recently were able to put up a call as civil society and said, we do not want this coal project in Lamu because it is a danger to our community. And their call was heard by government and this project was stopped. But this is the luxury that you lose the moment you join the Energy Charter Treaty, because that is automatically going to lead to a dispute. And then you will end up having to incur a lot of costs in terms of, you know, trying to settle the dispute. So there's a lot that we're going to lose, and less or nothing that we're going to win or get or benefit from this Energy Charter Treaty. So I think if we get to understand and appreciate those dynamics of the dangers that come around the Energy Charter Treaty, and draw a thick line between the myth that has been told to us, but also reflect on the realities, then I think that maybe it will be a good step towards, and I can confidently tell you that we recently engaged our government, and they told us that they share similar sentiments. They realized that joining the Energy Charter Treaty is not one of the best decisions. And I think that if that is really right, very soon we'll hear that Uganda is probably not continuing with, you know, trying to sit to the ECT. So that kind of appreciation is what we need to see globally, so that we all collectively put an end to this Energy Charter Treaty.
Awesome. I think so. This really comes down to democratic processes, as you pointed out, the process in Kenya, for instance, where people can actually have a say in how their country is run and what agreements their government can enter into. I see it from a Zimbabwean perspective. I'm Zimbabwean, and our government is every other day announcing some big deal, some big investment deal that's coming in. Currently, we have a big problem with the refuse collection deal with the Pomona industrial dump in Harare. So it's not just energy, it's essentially every deal that is being signed with international corporations requires more scrutiny and I guess, more analysis from a policy perspective by regular people, by policymakers, by everyone involved. I'll then just like to ask both of you, what would be your closing sentiments in this conversation? Perhaps starting with you, Olivia.
Oh, thank you. To be honest, I would, if I was asked right now in front of my president, I'll be like, should we please stay away from this ECT, not to sign it? And also, our policymakers and our negotiators, they should be well informed prior to signing any other agreement, because we have a lot of them already in place, and they're not doing us any good. They are all working for the investors and not for us as a country.
Mm-hmm. And yourself, Brenda?
Thank you. I think that for me, countries, especially those that intend to accede to the ECT, first of all, need to reflect on what are the global trends when it comes to the Energy Charter Treaty, and get to know that information, and to get to appreciate that there are a lot of alternatives that we could use to explore our energy resources. But most importantly, for us as civil society, as, you know, development partners, for us to combine efforts and ensure that we put a call towards the end of the Energy Charter Treaty, because it is a danger to our communities, our environment, our host communities. And there's a lot that we lose if we go on with acceding to the Energy Charter Treaty.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I will share the links the moment everything is.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I have been your host, Sean Macheza. This was a conversation with Olivia Costa, who is the Executive Director of Tanzania Trade and Investment Coalition, together with Brenda Akankunda, who works with the Southern and Eastern Africa Trade Information and Negotiations Institute, SEATINI. If we are to change the world and make things more just, equitable, and fair, we need to understand how things work and how those in power maintain that power and what are the pillars that support them. At TNI, we've built an entire archive of research on the Energy Charter Treaty and more broadly on Investor-State Dispute Settlement, ISDS. I invite you to explore it and to use it to get a better grasp of the factors that shape the world we live in. As a reminder, between 14 and 17 September, TNI is hosting its first State of the World Conference, an exciting opportunity to hear from some of the best scholar activists worldwide with a truly internationalist analysis of the state of the world. Please see the sign-up link in the podcast description or simply check our website. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from. And please write us a review, which will only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today, and see you next time.